to our training regarding our procedure. City Attorney, please begin.
So, to start off, this is a training on parliamentary procedure. I want to start with a caveat that I am in no way an expert on parliamentary procedure. This is the Robert's Rules of Order that the city uses, and it is the 1915 version that is adopted into our code. So we did not in 1970s. They came out with an updated, newly revised version that was never reflected in the city's code. So it's archaic and difficult to read. My best practical advice in navigating is to kind of disregard that there's a 1915 versus 1970s version, because for most purposes, it really doesn't matter. And rely on the guide that Brenda gave you. I think that's the most useful. Or any other, if you have questions, any other, you know, not that all of you are very intelligent people, but Robert's Rules for Dummies or those types of guides can be really helpful. You could get a copy of this on Amazon. The older versions are almost always used. Mine was originally owned by Beverly Robertson. I think purchased used by my stepfather. He was a planning commissioner of Springfield and city councilor, and he handed it down to me when I got my job. So this has been a well-loved copy, but I don't recommend going out and buying one if you...
I have a couple too in our library if you need it.
They're in any library as well, but they're not the actual Robert's Rules is not necessarily the best resource. I'm going to focus on sort of like three levels of procedure. If you think about it, like the overriding level are the Planning Commission's bylaws, which are adopted by the City Council as part of the Development Code. Those are in your packet. And those kind of govern you at the highest level and all aspects of the work that you do on the Commission and your procedures. And then below that are the public hearing procedures of the Springfield Development Code. Both of those are ordinances and can be changed by the Council, but the bylaws are just more general and kind of up there. And then the public hearing processes are more specific. And then after both of those two, kind of not in the packet, but there's sort of the things that you have agreed on, the way you're going to run your agendas, and so there's just Brenda's standard template, and you follow that. And then only after you get through sort of what those things all tell you to do, do you start to rely on parliamentary procedure.
Is it not working for you? Is it on the side?
Turn it off on the side.
No, on it.
Oh, no, that's not the power button. Okay, I do that every time. Okay, so the Planning Commission bylaws and the Municipal Code, you've probably all read these before, and they're in the packet. There's limitations on how many of you there are and what types of professions you can be in. It's not really your concern. The council considers that when they're considering who to appoint. You're limited to four-year terms, and the council operating policies say you can only serve two of those unless they override. I think most importantly for the procedural basis is that a quorum of you are a majority who are then appointed. So if somebody, we had an instance recently where Commissioner Landon had yet been reappointed and there were a number of other vacancies, and so the actual appointed members of the commission were smaller, to where you could have a majority of the appointed members wouldn't be four, which is what the majority is when it's fully appointed. You avoid creating a problem where you can't meet with a quorum by just having a majority be of those appointed rather than a majority of seven. By your bylaws, you're supposed to meet at least one time a month or as designated. It's been designated that you meet twice a month, but you can also meet specially as determined, which has happened in the past. And then by municipal code, your responsibilities are to recommend to the council on legislative matters and to do quasi-judicial review on development applications. And none of that should be new to you. The bylaws also call for the appointment of a chair and vice chair annually.
Yes, does the meetings, didn't say anything at all about our recess.
About your recess?
Recess.
Oh, and we don't meet in August.
It's not formally in your
bylaws.
In your bylaws to take a recess. It's something that the council approves through their policies and procedures, and so it's not been an issue.
Okay.
I think if somebody, the recess is not formalized anywhere, but it hasn't.
It's just a standard practice that council does and that we do.
And the council, I think it's in their operating policies and procedures, which they do adopt.
Yeah.
But that's a good point.
Haven't we had instances where we have not met at least once a month?
Yes, but it's always been approved.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, we let CMO know, city manager's office know.
Otherwise, I'd visualize you'd have to create some kind of artificial agenda.
Right, and they have taken those stance that you are volunteers and that we just don't want to waste your time by coming in if there's not a topic. I don't think you're going to have that problem this coming year.
And it's a schedule. You know, it's the meeting is held, but it's scheduled, and you made yourselves available to meet. The times have been canceled. There's been nothing on the agenda except for outside of recesses. Yeah. There's been nothing on the agenda for you to meet over. So, moving now to the development code. The development code designates the duties of the presiding officer. The presiding officer is the chairperson, or for the planning commission, or in his or her absence, it's the vice chairperson. It is the mayor for the city council. The duties of the presiding officer are to sort of regulate the meeting. I think you're all pretty familiar with those duties. You see them, I think, in action. Should it ever come up, this is something that I don't think has ever come up in recent memory, but if someone were to challenge a commissioner for bias, it wouldn't be up to the individual commissioner who's challenged for bias whether or not they participate. It's not like a conflict of interest where you sort of self-declare and decide to move forward. The chair actually rules on whether that commissioner has bias or not. I wanted to go through what the development code says that the order of procedure is, because I think that we make adjustments or we do things slightly differently mm-hmm. in practice, but I think it's good to go back and look at what the code says, partly because I think we can have a discussion about, does following the code strictly, would that work better? Should we think about other changes we might make? You know, the development code will be updated in its entirety, so if there's a different way to approach things, it's a good time to start thinking about that at least, and we can carry that on. The chair opens the public hearing first, and then after the public hearing is opened, under the code, the chair offers the explanation of the nature of the application, criteria of approval, and the legal disclaimers. In practice, the chair has turned it over to the city attorney to do that. That's not a problem, but if you were to strictly read the code, the chair might take that on. And then there's disclosures of conflict, bias, or ex parte. Citizens are invited to offer objections to the Planning Commission's jurisdiction. It was not something that we were always doing, and Sandy found mm-hmm. that after she came on, it took on that role, and so we've added that in. And then it's the staff report. I wanted to note that even though the council hasn't called upon a Planning Commission to do this, there's a formal part of the public hearing process where the council could decide to ask for a formal report from the Planning Commission. Then it's the applicant provides testimony, and then it's those in favor, those neutral, and those opposed. And I would note that that's the same for legislative and quasi-judicial, so we kind of make people pick sides, even in legislative. Not every jurisdiction has the same public hearing process for both types of public hearings. Then there's a staff summary, and then there's applicant rebuttal. The chair sets the scope of the rebuttal, and so the chair could limit it to only rebuttal of new issues raised in the public testimony, or could open it up to everything. In quasi-judicial world, it gets kind of tricky, because if the applicant says something new in rebuttal, then you have to allow citizens to respond to the new evidence raised in the applicant's rebuttal, and then you have to allow the applicant to surrebut the new, so it can kind of be cyclical. Then there's questions to the staff, applicant, and members of the public, and again, if new evidence is brought forward in that time and accepted by the chair, or not rejected, then you might also need to go through rounds of letting people speak more and having more rebuttal opportunities. And then you would close the public hearing or continue to a certain date, time, or place, and then close the written record or extend upon request. The next slide, I want to break that down more for you, but for now I'm just going to skip over it. Then you would have your discussion of policy issues and compliance with the criteria of approval. The code says that questions to staff and the public at that point are okay, but I would recommend not doing that. I don't think that's consistent with what a public hearing and record are supposed to encapsulate. And so you haven't been doing that. You've been waiting, and you've been closing that once you're done with your questions. And then you would make a decision based on findings. So it's really in 16 and 17 there that parliamentary procedure comes into play. So the closing the hearing and record, this isn't parliamentary procedure per se, but it's procedure under the development code, and so I wanted to touch on it. So once you come to the end of your public comment and questions, you make a decision about whether to close the hearing or record. I think the first thing that you think about is, like, do you need more information than what's been presented? Are there gaps in the staff report? Are there things that you don't know and aren't available to you to ask questions at that time? The application that you've continued to the next meeting is an example. There's traffic information that what you couldn't elicit from further testimony. So then you would, the best practice is to continue the public hearing and announce a date, time, and place for that public hearing. Alternately, you could close the public hearing and leave open the written record if it was just very something, I think, very specific you were looking for. The general rule is 777, 7 days for additional evidence, 7 days for public comment on that additional evidence, and 7 days for the applicant to have the final word. If you don't, based on what you're looking at, think that you need more information, then you would consider whether anyone had requested to continue the hearing. That's always discretionary with the Planning Commission. It doesn't matter, quasi-judicial or legislative. If you do use your discretion to continue, again, you have to state when that hearing is being continued to. You can't leave it open-ended. If no one's requested it or you decline a request, then you would close the public hearing. Then you would analyze whether there was a request to leave the record open. If it's quasi-judicial, you must extend it under that 777 rule. You don't have a choice there. If it's a legislative matter, it's at your option. If you don't have a quasi-judicial request or you decide not to in a legislative matter and no one's asked for it, then you close the written record. I wanted to point out that if the public hearing is continued, you just stop there. There's no need to close and open the written record. It's automatic. You cannot have an open public hearing without an open record. But you can have an open record without an open public hearing. And then during deliberations, it's always an option to go back and reopen a public hearing or a written record. I wanted to point out that if that happens at a later date, if you've closed a public hearing and then you meet in 2 weeks to deliberate, and at that time you determine you needed more information, we may be required under Oregon law to reopen the public hearing in another 2 weeks and provide notification to people who have previously appeared or to the public on that. So when do we need to strictly follow a procedure? I think this is something that comes up, like when can we kind of do what works versus when do we have to follow the letter of the code or the law or the Robert's Rules? It's important for public hearings to follow what the code says with sort of two caveats. One is that the code itself says you can suspend with majority vote any of those rules or procedures that aren't required by law. And those things required by law are those quasi-judicial public hearing rules about extending the written record, telling people what the criteria of approval are and how to appeal. And I'm always available to answer questions on if something's required or just part of the code. And then under land use law, if we mess up and we don't follow something that we were otherwise required to, but nobody was prejudiced, nobody was harmed or not allowed to speak or hurt in the way they offered their testimony, then it's not something you can be overturned on appeal for. And parliamentary procedure itself, I also wanted to make clear, it's not a strict requirement. Basically, anything goes as long as it's with the consent of the commission as a whole, obviously within reason and within legal requirements. And then my last point on following procedure is a point of order can interrupt anything. So if there's ever a question about are we following the procedures, are we doing the right thing, the county, I think if you've ever watched their commission, they do this regularly, they'll say point of order, and then they'll stop and have a discussion about what the proper procedures are. And that could be a sidebar with me, it could be a question to Sandy, it could be a whole group discussion about the best way to proceed. It doesn't have to be necessarily a legal question. It could be a question about what's just the best way for us to work this out that's divorced from what final decision should we make. So I wanted to just bring up that's always out there. And it's kind of a way for the public, especially for them to understand, if they're at all familiar with procedure, that you're just breaking to talk about the procedure. You're going to come back to the merits, you're not disregarding anything that's important. Okay, so now we're going to move on to making motions. This is the sort of the basics and the fundamentals. The first, you don't need motions to follow the regular agenda. I wanted to point that out. Thank you, Matthew.
You're welcome.
So the chair just announces the order of business. There's no even under the most formal rules, you don't need a motion to open the public hearing. It's just open when it's on the agenda. The chair formally recognizes speakers, and that a speaker under the formal rules makes a motion prior to any discussion or deliberation. A motion needs to either state the specific action that the person is moving to accomplish, or it could reference a proposed resolution or order to be adopted. In practice, we've had very formal descriptive motions and then orders that you ultimately adopt, but if it worked better for the commission, we could talk about streamlining those motions so that you're moving to approve the order, and then when you're voting on or making amendments, you're talking about how you would alter that order. That could be another way to do things for some efficiencies we could realize. This is always like parliamentarians always get that out of shape over. You don't motion to do something, you move to. I don't think I've ever heard a planning commissioner that's here say I motion to. I think you're all very good at that, but that's like a sort of an error that people will frequently point out. And I wanted to point out too that if just because you move to do something does not mean you are ultimately required to vote for that. There's a archaic rule that says that once you've moved to accomplish something, you're not allowed to speak in opposition to your own motion. But that rule is not, first of all, by consent, you can do anything you want. And I also think it's not, Robert's rules are really for, not really intended for local government bodies as much as they are for other types of business or nonprofit organizations or boards. And so I think that there's an interest because you need to move stuff forward. I think there's a real reason a planning commissioner may move to approve an application and then ultimately have some serious discussion about why they don't actually support voting for their motion. It can just be a way to kick things off. Motions, to adopt, approve, or deny applications always need to be seconded. There's a formal step. Number five is the formal step that the motion's sort of like in play once the chair has announced the motion and restated it. So after the second, or even before the second, the person who made the motion can change it. So if somebody, we do this in practice, somebody moves to approve the application and someone else is like, well, wait, but don't you mean approve it with the conditions outlined in the staff report? Oh yes, I mean approve with conditions outlined in the staff report. You don't need to like withdraw your motion, make a new motion. You don't need to if the motion's been seconded but the chair hasn't restated, you don't need to get that person who seconded's permission. However, if it's really different, that person could verbally withdraw their second. But you can be pretty informal up to the time that the chair restates the motion. Once the chair has restated the motion, if you're following formal rules, you have to follow slightly more formal procedures to change it. Any questions on that?
I just wanted to say I appreciate how you do the motions. You restate it, and then you second it, and then you tell me, because I'm looking down a lot, and you always state who made the motion and who made the second. So I have to say I really appreciate that.
Yeah, that was Greg trying to follow Commissioner James' lead.
And that's like
tough act to
it's
follow.
A best practice for people who are taking minutes, but it's also like I didn't always know that restating the motion by the chair is actually like if you're following formal procedure, that's a critical point. So before a motion, again, before it's announced by the chair, it can be withdrawn or modified without a second. But after it's announced by the chair, it can be modified with unanimous consent, and it can be withdrawn with, that was a typo, unanimous. I was in Disneyland last week. consent, or you can amend it. And to amend a motion, the purpose is to make changes to the original motion, or you can amend a motion to separate it out into multiple parts. So I think the example is if the motion is to take the blue bus to the city of Eugene, then you could amend that motion to first decide whether to take a bus, and then second decide whether the bus should be blue. You can separate those out. A motion to amend a motion requires a second. You can debate the amendment. It requires a separate vote on the amendment. These can kind of stack on top of each other. When you're making a decision, you should be debating only on the immediately preceding question. So if you have a question on an amendment, if you have a proposed amendment, you should be talking about the merits of that amendment. You can, and it's outlined pretty well in here. There's other kinds of like points of information that you could raise where if you want to interject and you want information on something, you can do that. But your debate and your discussion should be oriented around the last motion that was made. And then once you're kind of done debating, when no one has anything else to say, then the chair calls for a vote. I think you do that. But alternately, any single commissioner could call a question, and that just stops debate where it's at. By just saying, I call the previous question, or you could say, I call the questions of, if you want people to just immediately vote, you know, I call the questions of whether we should take the bus and what color the bus should be, then you're going to call for the immediate votes on both of them. There's no debate on a motion to call the question. There's no second. You just immediately say, I call the question, and then the chair calls for a vote on whether or not. You're voting to vote, so you have to give a two-thirds approval that you want to vote to then vote, because it cuts off debate. And if that passes, then you would immediately vote on whatever motions were identified that the speaker was calling the question on.
We've seen so this. Like, you guys don't usually do this, but Lane County does it a lot. And
you're a very, you know, one thing I do want to say about this very formal process is that the Planning Commission's standards of operation sort of informally have been that you try to reach consensus and you debate and have that, and then you make a formal motion. Mm-hmm. And you might further amend or do other things after that point, but you try to discuss things before there's a motion on the table. And while technically Robert's rules would say that that's not the correct thing to do, whatever you all can consent and do cooperatively is always fine. So there's no issue with doing things the way that you've been doing them. I think that one of the benefits of knowing formal procedure and being able to follow it is that if there's an application or a process that is in front of you that is likely to have a lot of public engagement or maybe a lot of emotional testimony, then more formality on the part of the Planning Commission can translate into more formality in the audience. And so that you may decide that you want to be more formal for certain applications or certain decision-making processes than you are on other ones. You could also decide that you want to keep your informality because that might encourage the community to also respond with a more cooperative tone. It's, mm-hmm. I think it's in your ability to make that decision. If you had a different composition of the commission where you didn't work so cooperatively, you might also find that like formal procedures help you move through things, which I think happens more with, you know, Lane County, where there's such a diversity of viewpoints, and less, not less collegiality, but they just, they don't work towards consensus in the same way that I've seen City of Springfield. And then finally, like a last point on decision making, because you're the Planning Commission, whether legislative or quasi-judicial, your decisions have to be based on findings in the record. Those are usually stated in the staff report, but sometimes you may make a decision in a meeting that's not stated in the staff report, or you heard additional testimony and you want to make a finding that you think that the testimony that there's a, you know, that there needs to be a study of this intersection or something like that, that wasn't in the staff report and you want that to be a finding, so you should include that in your motion. And then kind of the last point is that just because a motion to approve an application fails to pass does not mean the application is denied. You would then need to either have a motion to deny an application that passes, or follow up with an application to approve the application under different conditions. So you don't just, in sort of logical sense, you would think, well, if we voted not to approve the application, then that means it's dead, but that's not actually, especially under Oregon land use law, you have to make a decision to deny. And that has to also be based on findings, which if you're denying an application and the staff report recommends approval, is probably going to be a process of working collaboratively with Sandy and I or whoever's there from staff to articulate the reasons that an application's being denied. And similarly with conditions of approval that aren't outlined in the staff report, it would be good to have a finding formally adopted that states the basis for that. And that's all that I have, but I'm available to answer questions. I think we're going to have another training on quasi-judicial requirements like more specifically, but I, you know, it's hard to separate out quasi judicial procedures from Robert's rules, so we did touch on a little bit of both. Yeah.
I think we've all seen a couple of examples recently of changes in the way we do things based on a closer reading of the municipal code, either by Sandy or through Sandy. And so the question is, I see two different routes. One is that we change incrementally how we do things, or the second would be changing the reading of the municipal code. Mm-hmm. So on each one of these changes that are considered, mm-hmm. does that go through legal as determine whether we change or we don't change?
Well, there's certain things. Sandy and I have discussed a lot of these before they've been brought to you. There are certain things like the fact that I read the quasi-judicial hearing notice rather than Chair Cuevla or Chair James. You know, those are not going to prejudice anyone's rights. Those aren't legally required. So we haven't told the commission we're going to change the way we're suggesting you change. There was a change made to allow the opportunity to challenge the Planning Commission jurisdiction. That definitely would be a prejudicial, that could, not in every case, but if there really was an issue with lack of jurisdiction, it would be very prejudicial to someone not to have the opportunity to raise that. So that was something where in discussing that, it's like, no, we definitely need to add that back in. So I think for the most part, and when things have been changed, there's been a discussion about, is this one of those procedures where we're not technically following the code, but it's not hurting anybody, it's not really a requirement from state law, by consent we can do it, we've done it for a long time, or is this something that really is going to save us from needless land use appeals, or from somebody sort of not embarrassing the Planning Commission, but bringing up like, you know, well, you should have followed this, and having to say, you are completely right, and we, you know, so I think like the example of jurisdiction is one of those.
What I'm getting from that is that you, in essence, are interpreting the municipal code rather loosely.
Well, it's not, I wouldn't say that it's loosely. I would say that Oregon law says you have to follow procedures unless they are, if failing to do so causes prejudice. And so, based on what the law says, you can, by a majority vote, or under Robert's rules, by consent of everyone involved, you can deviate from the procedures you've set out for yourselves. We're going to recommend you not do that when it causes prejudice.
But in essence, that's on a different level of interpretation. If you're looking at specifics of the statute and what's required versus the nuances of the code.
I think for the most part we follow the code. I can only think of...
Well, I mean, you've cited already tonight examples where you don't specifically follow the detailed language of the code. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a few instances.
And I think it's also germane to mention that we are going through code revisions. Mm-hmm. And if there are certain instances where we can easily do something, for instance, where the chair reads versus the city attorney reads, if we can just in say that it shall be done, mm-hmm. and not specify who does it, that takes care of that problem.
And the chair can designate their responsibilities, yeah. to another person. Mm-hmm. So even though it's written that the chair reads this, like the way that you just generally read code is that it's generally a person identified or their designee. Mm-hmm. And so...
And we did that in one of our past meetings.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently. I think he always turns the floor.
The recent changes I was mentioning were municipal code, not development code.
And the bylaws of the... Yeah. So the Kent City Council would adopt bylaw changes. In terms of their recess, that is adopted by them. That they adopt that in their council operating policies and procedures, which they have the authority to do under the municipal code, and that sets forth what the recesses are. So I don't think it's a conflict between the two. The recess isn't specifically mentioned, but I wouldn't view that as like that we're loosely interpreting. We're following what the code says. The council can make their policies, and they do that, and we follow that. So.
And we do call you in on those recesses if need be.
Right. Well, we've always had that understanding. Particularly when you have timelines that you have to maintain.
Yeah.
I had a question regarding, it is a hearing body jurisdiction. It's the Planning Commission shall hear, the hearings official shall hear, and the City Council shall hear. I noticed that it has us under the Planning Commission under A2 and it has the council under C1 doing the same work.
It's appeals. Additional, the additional word is appeals.
Oh, appeal.
So you hear, so what the planning commission hears is the first instance of the type 3s, and then if they appeal your decision, that's...
I see the word, and I did understand that.
It's confusing, I think, because right above that it says the planning commission hears type 2 appeals.
Exactly.
So that's when staff, director, decision, and then it's appealed to you.
Okay. That was pretty much my only question. Any further questions? I think we could adjourn.
This was very helpful. Thank you.